This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, all. Good morning, all. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Belinda Cora, coming to you live from Port Moresby. Thank you for joining me. Today on the show, here in Papua New Guinea, a HIV awareness campaign gets underway as cases surge.
Every day we are made aware of the data that's coming from the clinics about, you know, pregnant mothers being infected, young people being infected, older men.
Also, the election campaign heats up in Samoa as voters call for an end to the political drama.
My advice for all leaders is to remember the very people who elected you to parliament.
And we cross to Tonga, where a huge weekend of rugby is taking shape. All that and more coming up. Let's get started. But first, New Caledonia's main pro-independence coalition has boycotted talks with France's overseas minister, who is visiting the territory this week. It comes as Manuel Valls attempts to salvage the Bouzy-Val Accord, a draft agreement signed last month that the FLNKS have since rejected. As Finau Fonua reports, Manuel Valls has been holding bilateral talks in the hopes of translating the Bouzy-Val Accord into legislation.
Dans l'accord de Bougival, ne remet en cause les fondements de l'accord de Nouméa.
Earlier this week, France's overseas minister Manuel Valls expressed his disappointment that the Bougainville Accord had been rejected. The accord is a draft agreement signed last month between pro-independence and French loyalist parties that would allow for the creation of a state of New Caledonia that would have more autonomy over its affairs and own citizenship. But Islands business correspondent Nick McClellan says the largest pro-independence party, Union Caledion, opposes the deal because they view it as being designed specifically to get New Caledonia off the UN's decolonization list.
Overseas Minister Valls held bilateral meetings with all the different parliamentary groups. The FLNKS did meet with him bilaterally, but they came out stressing that they did not accept the basic framework that's being proposed. Dominique Fucci, who's Secretary General of the largest independence party, Union Caledonienne, said that the Bougival Agreement is incompatible with the right to self-determination, and it represents France's desire to remove New Caledonia from the list of countries to be decolonized.
But there's division amongst the pro-independence groups. Some believe the accord is a stepping stone to independence. Party of Connacht Liberation spokesperson Judicole Selafin says they haven't been swayed by the FLNKS's hardline position.
There's always been division within the FLNKS between parties. Today, the division is not on the objective. It's the route specifically that has been taken towards independence that the FLNKS is not happy about.
Valls has spent the week in this divided landscape, attempting to hold bilateral talks with pro-independence parties to try and find a way to make the Bougainville Accord work. McClellan says the FLNKS has boycotted the discussions.
He called together a meeting of a negotiating committee to look at the text of the agreement signed in July in Bougival in France. But the FLNKS, the main independence coalition, didn't join in that meeting. And so you can see some pro-independence forces were there, others were not. And that's a reflection about concerns about the way this agreement has to be translated into law.
Last month, when the draft agreement was originally signed, many New Caledonian locals were relieved that there had been progress made after the French territory was wrecked by violence last year, leaving the economy in shambles. University of New Caledonia Professor Selifanau Gumatal says many people are now disappointed that talks have been stalled, exhausted by months of political and ethnic tensions.
It's sad. I'm not happy about it. I think they are mistaken in doing it, because when they said that it doesn't guarantee, you know, in respect of Kanak identity and self-determination, it doesn't end self-determination. It just changes the modalities of the way that self-determination is exercised. So I do believe they are mistaken in rejecting it, and I deplore the fact that they are rejecting.
Today, Manuel Valls is set to continue talks with New Caledonia's political factions and is scheduled to fly back to France tomorrow. McClellan says Valls' mission this week to salvage the Bougainville Accord faces an uphill battle.
The stumbling block in all of this, and it's recognised by most parties, including, I think, the French government, is that there needs to be an agreement of all major political forces. During the negotiations this week, around the table, the vast majority of parliamentary groups, 5 out of 6 parliamentary groups, were represented at the talks. But coming out of that meeting, even parties opposed to independence recognise that there are problems in the way forward. Milakula Tukumoli, who's leader of Eveille Oceanienne, they're anti-independence but certainly want a peaceful transition forward. He said after meeting with Valls that an agreement without the FLNKS has never existed in the history of New Caledonia going back 40 or 50 years. And we can't impose things or try to do things without consensus.
That was Islands business reporter Nick McClellan speaking there. Samoans head to the polls later this month to elect a new government after a year of instability. For many, the cost of living is the big issue they want addressed, as well as an end to the political chaos. Samoa reporter Adele Frian has the story.
On the streets of Samoa's capital, Apia, election season is in full swing. Billboards are popping up all over the city. Taxi driver Mo'autasiki Rifisua says for him and many others, the rise in the cost of living is the big issue.
The first thing is a box of chicken. 5 years ago, it was around $20 per box. That's a good example, because now a box of chicken costs over $50.
Mo'autasiki Rifisua says people are also sick of the political dramas of the last year.
My advice for all leaders is to remember the very people who elected you to parliament. We don't want to see a Samoa that fights in parliament exchanging harsh words.
Elections here have traditionally been a predictable affair, but the last one 4 years ago delivered a change of government for the first time in 40 years. And the country's first female prime minister, Fiamme Naomi Mutaafa, her election was celebrated here and abroad. But this year, infighting fractured her ruling Fast Party, and she narrowly survived 2 no-confidence votes. For many Samoans, the recent instability has felt chaotic.
It's like it's every person for themselves, not coming together as one. I thought Samoa was a united country. If we see they're fighting with each other, we will do the same. But if they are in harmony, we will follow.
This election is shaping up as a three-cornered contest between Fiamme Naomi Mutaafa's newly formed Samoa Uniting Party, her former Fast Party, and the Human Rights Protection Party, HRPP, led by the man the PM unseated at the last election, former longtime Prime Minister Tuleipa Selele Malilingoi. The 81-year-old is running on a suite of populist policies, including a $300 annual payment to every Samoan and a promise to build a bridge between the country's 2 main islands.
The major drive for us is to restore the confidence of the international community to the leadership of Samoa, to restore the stability of our country, of Samoa.
Fiamme Naomi Mutaafa maintains she is the best person to lead the country.
We're very much about the rule of law, which has been a contentious issue not only with the HIPP, but with the other side of the FAS party.
Adding to the uncertainty is the record number of independent candidates contesting this election. Younger Samoans like arts teacher Moiloto Ilinganoa want to see more youthful faces in the parliament.
It's pretty sad because the people who are in parliament, they are all people who are literally probably the same age as my grandparents.
Though she'd be happy with the government focused on the issues that matter to people.
If there is no stable foundation, there is no stable house.
Samoa teacher Moiloto Ilunganoa ending that report from Adele Frian in Apia. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Belinda Cora coming to you live from Port Moresby. And here in the capital, a HIV awareness campaign is underway to address the national health crisis. The WHO has found that new infections have doubled in the last decade with 11,000 new cases recorded in the last year. I spoke with Melanie Palili, the program manager for IGAD Hope, the peak body for people living with HIV in PNG, who says the drive is part of a 100-day emergency plan.
We have four teams at the moment stationed in four locations this week alone. So this will continue over the next 3 weeks. And basically, we are doing HIV, just giving out basic information on HIV. We are distributing condoms. We are distributing IC materials on HIV and AIDS. We are doing testing as well for those who want to do HIV testing. And we are referring clients to the health facilities as well.
HIV and AIDS awareness has been lagging in all aspects over the last couple of years, particularly due to funding support. What do you think this has now led to?
It has been observed. It's obvious that there hasn't been much awareness on HIV. I don't think not just in the last 2 years, but I think over a span of 5 years, there hasn't been much work being done on educating the public about HIV. And I think one of the reasons to that would be the fact that at one point we did have provincial AIDS Council secretariat offices in each of the provinces, and they pretty much were the link in getting from service providers right into the communities. So once those PACs or provincial AIDS Council secretariat offices were done away with, information wasn't really going down to the communities. And at some point, HIV, work around HIV was not prioritized. It wasn't really a focus by the National Department of Health. Their priorities and funding shifted, and HIV wasn't really an issue at that time. And so much of the HIV work was really up to international non-government organizations or civil society organizations, and it was just limited to just probably doing a little bit of pamphlets, posters, but not so much time and effort and resources focused put into this.
What are your biggest concerns right now?
HIV has certainly increased the infections of HIV. IGAD Hope actually works with people who are positive, people who are living with HIV. And we actually, the organization is a membership-driven organization, meaning that we have so many people who are members of IGAD Hope who are PLHIV. So, and because of fear and stigma, because of so much fear in terms of them coming out to declare their status, and there's so much discrimination around PLHIVs, you know, it's just not, many of the PLHIVs are not really talking about HIV. There's not much awareness going on. And so we think that, you know, HIV is gone. It's not here. But really, it's in the country and it's spreading. It's like a sleeping giant. It's actually like, you know, it's there, but it's spreading and no one is thinking it's serious, and it's just, you know, infections are going on almost every day. Every day we are made aware of the data that's coming from the clinics about, you know, pregnant mothers being infected, young people being infected, older men. It's the infection is, it's no respecter of age or man or your status, anything. It's just across. And my biggest concern is that because there's so much stigma and discrimination, people don't want to talk about HIV openly.
Melanie Palili, the program director or manager of IGAD Hope, speaking to me there.
Hold the front page!
And it's time to take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific region. And to do that, I'm joined by producer Kyle Evans. Kyle, how are you today?
Good morning, Belinda. I'm well. I'm both excited and very nervous because tonight, for the first time, I get to babysit my baby nephew, who my sister has very wisely entrusted me with.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. That sounds really great. Well, I hope you enjoy the sitter experience there tonight.
To be fair, I think my sister probably trusts my wife more than me, but no, I'm very, very much looking forward to it.
Well, I'll leave it to that. And do give me an update probably when we talk again live here on PegBeat about that.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's get into it. Kyle, 51 jobs could be on the chopping block at a major Fiji brand. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Belinda. Bit concerning, this one. So Fiji Water has announced a proposed restructure that could see 51 positions made redundant if it goes ahead. That's according to a letter sent to staff earlier this month where management outlined the need for change due to global economic uncertainty, which has been impacting every industry and sector. Fiji Water specifically would have been affected pretty hard by that 32% tariff placed on them by one of their biggest markets, that being the US. And they said job cuts will be considered essentially to increase efficiency.
That's quite concerning. Did they say when will staff would have a clear, probably an answer on the way forward?
So the company is going to consult with employees over the next 60 days before they make any final decision. If the restructure proceeds, employees will receive severance pay equivalent to 3 months' salary plus 2 weeks of pay for each year of service. But I've got to say, Belinda, given how transparent they've been in foreshadowing this, I think it's a near certainty these jobs will go. It's just a matter of when. So, look, I hope that if and when the hammer does come down, I hope that that everyone's okay.
Staying in Fiji, the government has moved to clarify misinformation spread by the chief of Fiji's Cancer Society. What's this about?
Yeah, another very interesting one as well, I've got to say. I first saw this reported yesterday in RNZ, where the CEO, Belinda Chan, said that newly diagnosed cancer patients were being told they must purchase their own chemotherapy medications or go without treatment entirely. I've got to say, my eyebrows really raised when I read that, because it just sounded, so incredible to me. And she actually called out Aspen Medical by name specifically. They're a private operator who manage hospitals in Lautoka and Bar, and she accused them of charging newly diagnosed patients medication at a cost of about 40,000 Fiji dollars. However, the government has since come out and said that claim is entirely untrue, labelling it all as misinformation. And Aspen Medical, meanwhile, has confirmed that no medication is being charged to patients either. So, yeah, look, I'm not quite sure where that information has come from.
And the upcoming Women's Rugby World Cup is shaping up as the most attended yet.
Yes, that is right. The Women's Rugby World Cup final at Twickenham next month is already at an 82,000 person sellout and will be the most attended Women's Rugby Union match in history. So that was the word from Gil Whitehead, the chair of the Women's Rugby World Cup. So take from that what you will. But if he's right, it would smash the previous record, which was at 66,000 fans, which was set at each of the sessions at the Women's Rugby Sevens tournament at the Paris Olympics. So, yeah, look, it's certainly shaping up to be a huge event. 375,000 tickets have already been sold at really reasonable prices as well, I've got to say. Only £10 for adults and £5 for children.
And when will the first match kick off?
Yeah, it all gets underway this weekend, Belinda. So we'll have England and USA at 4:30 PNG time. 40,000 tickets already sold for that one. And then some of the Pacific teams in action with Samoa playing Australia at 9 a.m. Saturday, followed by Fiji and Canada the following day.
Oh, that's going to be like a really good feast of footy. And just quickly, another big game for the PNG Hunters in the Queensland Cup.
Yes, talking about high-stakes games. So, look, another big game for the Hunters. They'll face the winner Manly Sea Eagles in Brisbane on Saturday, coming off a really impressive win against the Logan Magpies last week. They currently sit seventh, and you'd think they'd have to win at least one of their final two games to cement a finals berth. But given their rounding form at the right time, look, I trust them very much to do that. Meanwhile, I just wanted to give a quick shout-out to the great scrum half, Will Genia, who announced his retirement from rugby union yesterday. Look, absolute Wallabies great, who was obviously born in PNG, moved to Australia at age 12 and just had a fantastic career. 110 tests for Australia, captaining Australia three times. But Bells, I can still remember going to watch him play when he was with the Queensland Reds against my ACT Brumbies growing up. I can't believe how fast his career's come and gone, but I'm glad I got to watch him.
Yes, definitely. He's been a legend in the rugby league the rugby league arena for quite a long while now. Thanks for that, Kyle, and thanks very much for our news wrap this morning.
Not a problem at all.
Years of age, that's the age someone can legally marry in the Solomon Islands. But that may soon change thanks to a pending review of the country's Marriage and Divorce Act. Local media has reported that Foreign Minister Peter Chanel Agovaka has proposed a change to a section of the Act which would see marriage laws align with the voting age of 18. Child safety advocates and social groups have expressed support for the move. To find out more, we are now joined by Save the Children Solomon Islands Program Manager, Ellen Kahui. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning, Belinda and all listeners.
Thank you very much for joining us here this morning. Firstly, Ellen, how did you feel hearing that this proposal had been raised?
Yes, thank you, Belly. I'd say that it's incredibly encouraging to hear our government officials now emphasizing this urgent need to amend Section 10 of the Islanders Marriage Act, because we need to have stronger laws in place to better protect our children nationwide here. So, yeah, it is incredibly encouraging.
Save the Children has been part of the campaign called Make It 18, pushing for a change in the Marriage Act. How important is it from your perspective that this change is accepted by Solomon Islands Parliament?
Yes. So, well, this Make It 18 campaign lies at the very core of our initiative. So spearheaded by the coalition of Save the Children, World Vision and Child Fund, this project is a unified effort which is aimed squarely at effecting meaningful change, especially in how we safeguard our children. So as part of our project, we are advocating for legislative reform to strengthen specific laws to protect our children. And we saw that working hand in hand with stakeholder partners really propels our progress forward. If we're learning that members of parliament are now raising these issues in the legislature, especially in the floor of parliament, signals a sincere commitment to defending our children against child marriage in the country. Yeah.
Ellen, what dangers do children face, particularly women, if they are allowed to marry so young?
Yes, well, there are many adverse dangers that are related to women or girls getting married so young. But I'd say that early marriage of girls severely undermines their rights, yeah, especially when it comes to education, health, and future prospects. Because once married, girls are often unable to complete their schooling. There's also the cutting off of opportunities for further advancement in life. Noting also that their health is also at risk. And studies have also shown that adolescent pregnancies are both common among married girls and is also a leading cause of death for girls aged 15 and 19 worldwide, of course. Yeah.
Ellen, how common are teenage marriages within the Solomon Islands? Are the figures different for boys and girls?
Teenage marriage is very common here in the Solomon Islands because from data that we have collected, and you can also see this data in Make It 18 Situational Analysis report. Well, the data that was captured in that report shows that 21% of girls in Solomon Islands are married before the age of 18. 4% of boys are married before the age of 18. Yeah, and more so, the data that was captured in that report also stated that 6% of girls in Solomon Islands are even married before the age of 15. Now, this is an alarming trend that needs to be addressed. Hence, we have to ensure our governments amend this Section 10 of the Islanders' Marriage Act as soon as possible. Yeah.
Ellen, do the numbers differ in rural areas?
Yes. So from report gathered, it shows that 1 in 5 girls are married before 18, and in rural areas, it is 1 in 4. So there's really not a big difference, I must say. So this is an alarming rate because it shows that girls are indeed vulnerable to early marriage. Yeah. And there's also this quote from a girl child whom we interviewed during the consultation phase of the campaign, who strongly supported raising the legal age of marriage from 15 to 18 years. Yeah? And I also share this quote with the interviews I have with the Pacific Media Network. Yeah, in this quote, young Teresa powerfully advocated that 15 years old and age for beginning inside school yet. Yeah, this means 15 years old is still a child's age, and a child is supposed to be attending school at that age. Yeah, so these words highlighted the importance of giving children time to learn, grow, and prepare for the future instead of forcing them into early marriage. Yes, Ellie.
Now, I understand children of child brides also face risks. What kind of risks do they face?
Oh, well, the children of child brides face increased dangers. Yeah, like they are more likely to be born with a low birth weight, suffer from malnutrition.
Yes, sorry, continue.
Yes. So from your question, I'd say that the children of child brides face increased dangers. Yeah, like they're more likely to be born with a low birth weight, suffer from malnutrition, experience poor physical development, and face high rates of mortality than children born to older mothers. Yeah. And this is some of the many negative impacts of child marriage for girls. Yeah.
Thank you, Ellen, for that. And now that it's been reportedly raised in Parliament, what can we expect to see happen next?
Yes, so we call on the government to take the lead in addressing this critical issue. Our children are urgently asking for protection from child marriage, so it is vital that we not only act swiftly, but also work alongside committed service providers who are also actively advocating for children's rights, yeah? Because their involvement will be instrumental in raising awareness, gaining public support, and also driving meaningful change. So as the saying goes, every child deserves the right education, the chance to reach their full potential, and the protection that they are entitled to. And seeing that the public has made their stance clear, they support raising the legal age of marriage. So now it's time for government to respond. Yeah, like delaying the Section 10 of the Islanders Marriage Act only puts more children at risk. And I'd say that together we can end child marriage. Yeah, our children are the leaders of tomorrow. They are our leaders in the making. And it is our utmost responsibility to ensure that their safety and the future is secured. And again, as a key message from our Make It 18 advocacy goes, justice delayed is justice denied. So we are calling on everyone, not only in country, but also our brothers and sisters from the Pacific region to join us in advocating in whatever platforms that you're currently engaged in to make this change. Just support us in ensuring that our country make changes to Section 10 of the Islanders Marriage Act. So put simply, I'd say that let's make it 18. Yes, Belinda, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ellen, for joining us and also for sharing the vital information for there from the Save the Children Solomon Islands.
Thank you, Belinda, and it is indeed my
And that was Ellen Kahui, Save the Children Solomon Islands project manager, speaking to me there. Turning to sports now, it's shaping up to be a huge weekend for rugby union, both here in the Pacific and on the global stage. Tonga is hosting Pacific Nations Cup action in Nuku'alofa. For Tonga, the games aren't just about pride. They're also part of the qualifying pathway to the 2027 Rugby World Cup. And over in the UK, the Women's Rugby World Cup will kick off as well. To chat about it all, I'm joined now live from Tonga by our very own correspondent, Marianne Kupu, who is also my colleague. A very good morning to you.
Good morning, Toko. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, it's so great to hear your voice this morning. And I'm so humbled to actually have a quick talk with you as well on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Belinda. It's nice and gray here in Tonga right now. And it's exciting because it's Friday. Friday is Christmas Day for Tonga.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to come and see Tonga soon. But let's get into it, Marianne. How are people in Tonga feeling ahead of this weekend's Pacific Nations Cup match?
Well, Bells, the mood here is electric. Everyone is buzzing. You know, they've already had their flags. Their flags are out on the streets, even on their cars, like you normally see in New Zealand and in Australia when we have matches. Yes, we do have that here, but sometimes they take it to the extreme. We got the families are also getting their red T-shirts, and I've seen them yesterday wearing it about. Some of the schools had Mufti Day and they were told to wear red just to show support. People are proud and excited because this is just more than just a rugby game. It's about showing our Tongan pride. Yeah.
We've got a classic Pacific rivalry this weekend with Tonga versus Samoa. How crucial is this game for both teams?
Bells, it's very crucial. I mean, these are two of the biggest rugby nation in the Pacific, you know, including Fiji, of course. And whenever these two Pacific island meet, it's never just about another game. It's about bragging rights. It's about pride. It's about both team, you know, like it's just about trying to show like, who's the best in the Pacific between these two? It's just kind of like, I can just similarly say, you know, it's kind of like a friendly rivalry between Australia and New Zealand. That's what we have with Samoa, you know. And both teams know a win here tomorrow, this will also set the tone for the rest of the tournament.
Thanks, Marianne. And how significant is it for Tonga to be hosting this match, both for the players and the community there?
Oh yeah, it's a massive significant, Belinda. You know, for the players, it's nothing beats running out in front of their own country, and you know, just hearing the cheers, seeing the Red Sea, you know, that's a massive thing for them. And for the community, it's a chance for them to come together to celebrate not just about rugby, but also our culture and our unity. Here in Tonga, we may have different politic views, we may have different age group, but when it comes to sport, particularly rugby league or rugby union, that's one language that we all unite in. Hosting Samoa here also makes it extra, extra special for us.
This is Pacific Beat. Marianne Kupu is on the line from Tonga, and we're chatting all about rugby coming up this weekend. Over in the UK, the Women's Rugby World Cup is also set to kick off. Marianne, Fiji and Samoa are on the field this weekend. How significant is this Pacific representation at the Women's World Cup?
Well, Belinda, it's really a significant to see our Pacific sisters on the world stage. You know, they're carrying our flags. You know, it shows that there's a progress of women's rugby in the Pacific, and how much talent that we have in the islands, not only for women, for men, but also for women and girls. You know, it inspires that the next generation of young girls here at home, but not only here at home, Belinda, but also little Tongan girls and little Samoan girls and little Fijian girls all over the Pacific. You know, this is a very inspirational moment for women in sport, particularly in rugby.
Definitely. Thanks, Marianne, for also emphasizing on that. Tonga didn't qualify this time. What does that say about the challenges rugby or women's rugby faces in Tonga? And what's the feeling on the ground about this?
Well, Belinda, it shows that there is a big, there still is a big challenge here in Tonga. We have lack of resources, we have lack of funding and opportunities, but particularly we have our culture boundaries or barriers. Having said that, some schools here in Tonga do not encourage or support girls playing rugby. So our culture barriers also is still a challenge here in Tonga. But I can see there is some improvement. Better, and in my years here in school, we were only playing netball, period. That was the only sport that was given or offered in the schools. Now that there is other sports that are being offered in schools, including rugby and soccer and badminton and others, and other sports that both men and women can play. So the talent is there, but the support system needs to be stronger. I can say that people here feel disappointed, but also motivated to push harder to the future, especially with identifying what sport and talent that these girls are inspired and want to play for Tonga.
That's good to hear. And I know who you will be supporting this weekend, but can you tell us who you will definitely be cheering on for this Feast of Footy this weekend?
Definitely, I'll be cheering for Samoa here in the Viva. I'm going to be wearing blue, and I know I'm going to be pissing off a lot of people here in Tonga, but, you know, we've got to be a good sport, right? And it's all about supporting our Pacific sisters
on this stage. And I just want someone to feel at home and welcome. And I know that I have a little bit of someone running in my blood veins, so I'm definitely supporting someone.
Okay, thank you very much, Marianne. Yes, Marianne, thank you very much for that update. I do hope you have an enjoyable weekend. I know you will be supporting the Samoans, but hopefully when PNG comes, you will also be supporting the team PNG when we do come to Tonga anytime for rugby league.
Definitely not. I will support PNG. But yes, I love you, Bells. Au revoir, too, and have a great day.
Thank you very much. And that was our reporter, Marianne Kupo, speaking with us there from Nuku'alofa.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
7 years ago, Solomon Islands made history qualifying alongside New Zealand for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in South America. But for a while, the dream became a nightmare when it emerged that one of the Solomon players was overage. In the end, FIFA allowed the team to compete in the World Cup in 2018, but OFC still went ahead and punished the Solomon Islands Football Federation with a fine and ban from the next Oceania Under-16 tournament. However, they are back in the fold now and competing at the 2025 event on home territory in Honiara, where, as Christian Rita Au Manu Leong reports, they have put tight regulations in place to ensure that the 2017 debacle is not repeated.
2018 was a historic year when Solomon Islands Under-16 men's football team qualified for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Brazil. The qualification was marred by the eligibility controversy linked to fielding players who were too old. And the Solomon's Under-16 coach, Henry Farodo Jr., says he doesn't want history repeating.
Oh, yeah, of course. I think I remember that even quite well as well. I think after that, I think the Federation has really put a stamp on it and really want to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
The side known as Solomon Katukatus are back on hosting duties after being excluded at the last championship, with coach Farodo Jr. getting the hang of the new regulations.
So the process that the Federation has gone through now is when we get the trials, we get the players to bring their birth certificates with them. Other thing that the Federation do now, and I think it's probably the best thing, is we get the birth certificates and then we're going to go do another verification. And that is when we go to that's when we work with the Ministry of Health, and they've been very supportive in that. We get all the birth certificates that we've got in hand and we send it to the Ministry of Health, and they cross-check again with the birth certificates, and man, there's a lot of difference in that as well.
For Farodo Jr., when the criteria are not fulfilled, it may sometimes mean he is the bearer of bad news for some in a pool of talented players. But he believes the Federation is on the right track to managing age expectations.
I keep pushing for it as well, is we have to do it the right way with the admin staff as well. You know, we want the elite players to be eligible. We want the elite players in the academy space, for example, to be eligible, you know. And I think it's like a domino effect. If you do it properly there, it goes all the way through as well.
Some windy conditions out here in Solomon Islands, capital of Honiara, where local fans are starting to come in to witness the next generation of Pacific's football talent. Eight nations across Oceania are vying for top three spots at next year's Under-17 or FIFA Under-17 World Cup, which will be held in Qatar. So who do you think will win this Under-16 men's championship?
Okay, by New Caledonia.
Solomon Island.
I think New Zealand will win the championship.
Europeans, you never win.
New Caledonia.
In Group A, Fiji were the first team to book a place in the semi-finals after a commanding 5-0 victory over Cook Islands, and PNG are likely to join them. The tournament started badly for Solomon Islands in Group B, losing 5-2 to New Caledonia. But a 4-0 win over Samoa means their semi-final hopes are still alive, although their next opponents will be group favourites, New Zealand. However, coach Faroda Jr. remains hopeful that his side will continue to grow in confidence and make the most of their opportunities.
To win games, I think the process has to be in place, and I think we are working on the process now. Building on the first game, I think it's important that we stick to the process, we stick to our plan. And just because of the result doesn't mean we have to change a lot. There will be changes, but not a drastic change, because we believe that with what we've got now, when it comes to getting a result, I think we will definitely get a result.
Henry Farodo Jr., the Solomon Islands under-16 men's coach, ending that story by ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Christian Rita Aumonu-Leong. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main stories today. Recapping our top story, New Caledonia's main pro-independence coalition has boycotted talks with France's overseas minister, who is visiting the territory this week.
The FLNKS did meet with him bilaterally, but they came out stressing that they did not accept the basic framework that's being proposed.
We'll be back at the same time Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You also hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Eggy Tupo. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up also is Niger Daily. I'm Belinda Cora. Have a great day.
Salofalava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.